This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. At the controls this morning, Kyle Mabry. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. In just a moment here, we will be talking about a little bit about the history of timekeeping, and we will be talking with a fellow that is pretty well known here around our area on the U of I campus, Bruce Hannon. He is an emeritus professor of geography at the University of Illinois, well known as an environmentalist here in our part of the state, and he's someone who for about 40 years or so has been interested in the repair and maintenance of old mechanical clocks, and he has done some work on some significant clocks that are on the U of I campus, and he also has been involved in doing maintenance and work on the clock that's in the tower of the Champaign County Courthouse. And we'll talk a little bit about all of that in just a second here. This is also one of those times that we try to remind listeners how important their support is. And when I'm talking about support, I am not just talking about moral support. I'm talking about financial support. Moral support is all well and good, but it won't pay the bills. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about keeping the station going, keeping the station strong, and where we can look to the where we can look for that money. Best place we have is you, you who are listening right now. If you're not a supporter of the station, how about going online or picking up the telephone and giving us a call and making a pledge? And that would help us out. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me. He's been involved with WILO for a while. He was a producer for the show for a very long time, and now he's in charge of our web operations.
That's right. And I do want to emphasize it's important that each and every person who listens to public radio is a partner. And you know, this here we go. Public radio, right? This is what we do. We have to go on the air every once in a while and ask you to make a voluntary contribution. That's how we do this. 40% of our budget comes from you. But we think it's a lot better than airing commercials that interrupt the flow of Focus every 5 minutes or something like that. This is not the model of public radio. The model of public radio is we come to you and say, hey, can you give us a call, please? We'd like to keep this thing going. And if enough people do that, some 13,000 do, if we could get to 14,000, the future would be assured. So one call at a time, folks, 217-244-9455. Step up to the plate, or you can go online to willpledge.org.
Hey, thanks very much. Well, I'm happy to welcome here to the program Bruce Hannon. He is an emeritus professor of geography at the University of Illinois. He was on the faculty of geography for 30 years, more than 30 years. Also went to school here at the University of Illinois and has been with us before on this program to talk about environmental issues. We asked him here this morning, though, to talk about something else, which is near and dear to his heart and something that's something I think fair to say a vanishing art, and that is the repair, the maintenance of old mechanical clocks, something he's been doing now for something like 40 years. And we'll talk about some of the clocks that he has worked on the campus and talk a little bit about clocks and questions, whatever questions people have. You can give us a call. You want to talk with Bruce. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
I appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
So the story that I read was that you got into this because you got a clock and it stopped working and you tried to find someone to repair it and you couldn't.
Exactly.
Is that it?
Exactly right. And then fumbling around with it for months, finally got it going and figured out what was wrong with it. And that was the point of no return right there. The reward you get from doing that spurred me on to do it again and again and again. And finally, I was buying clocks just to feed the habit, so to speak. And so then having to sell them to keep the house from the collection. I was just telling someone else here that in that series, I had come across a very lovely old German time only clock that hung on the wall, and black, very, very nice piece. And my young daughter reminded me 30 years later, 35 years later, that I had sold her favorite clock. Well, I didn't realize it at the time, of course, but there you go. Regrets. Mm. Yeah. Well, some basis for the history of mechanical timekeeping is probably appropriate. It started in the 1300s, early 1300s, in a Cistercian monastery where the monks were required to rise and pray every 4 hours around the clock, so to speak, around the yet-to-be-invented clock. Mm-hmm. And the problem was finding out when 4 hours was up. They didn't care whether it was exactly at noon. There wasn't any noon at that time, and so on. So they would burn candles and had sand flowing through hourglasses, and someone had to stand there and watch or stay up and watch this whole process and then ring a bell, wake up everybody in every 4 hours. But somewhere along the line, and it's not known who or who all, there came people who were like blacksmiths, you'd call them today, but they could make gears and this sort of thing from their experience as millwrights and wind and flour mills and grinding mills, came up with the idea of controlled release of rotary motion. And that was really a breakthrough. That was, you can't say exactly when that happened, but it was in the early 1300s. And then at the same time, maybe independently, maybe not, Richard of Wallingford in England, God's clockmaker, as the English call him, also invented a similar kind of mechanism. And there is a clock today that's been running since that time in the Salisbury Cathedral. It's wound weekly and strikes a bell and so on. The early clocks, though, were so inaccurate because of the mechanism for releasing the gear train that they only had hour hands. Mm. And that's all the Cistercians monks needed anyway, was an hour hand. But to be exactly on the four-hour period was anything that was an improvement over burning candles and hourglasses would be greatly appreciated, I'm sure. And so an hour hand sufficed for a long time. And then they, in the 1600s, when Huygens, the Dutch physicist, and Galileo were working. They noticed, Galileo actually noticed by timing the weaving of the chandeliers in the church he was attending, using his pulse, saw that no matter how wide the arc was, that the chandeliers swung in the wind, apparently, the period or the time from one end of the swing to the other was constant. If it was a small swing, then it was fast. That is, it was slow. If it was a long swing, it was fast. So that the period, as far as he could tell with his heartbeat stopwatch, was the same. And that was an observation that was crucial to stepping up the accuracy of these mechanical clocks, because it changed from using a very inaccurate way of getting an oscillation to a much more accurate way, the pendulum. Mm-hmm. So they jumped. That was a jump forward in the 1600s, and then there appeared minute hands. And as these mechanisms improved and their understanding of them improved, the seconds hand appeared on clocks, so that we were keeping time ever more closely. Of course, when you have clocks, it isn't just that you'll be able to pray regularly, it's that you'll be able to welcome in the Industrial Age, which occurred in the early 1700s too, with the invention of the steam engine and later the Watt's vast improvement of the steam engine in the late 1700s. Coming along with that was this improvement in accuracy and timing, both so that you could time the production process is better, but also so that you could introduce this idea of a wage and how many hours you worked, mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. And that was very important. So, and then later on, of course, the timing of ships that went to sea needed, in that same period, in the 1700s, the English found that they could tell where their, at sea, they could tell where their ship was north and south by observations of the North Star or even the peak of the arc of the sun, but they couldn't tell where they were east and west. And the problem was how to solve this, because there were thousands of people dying as they crashed unexpectedly on various shores in the middle of the night. because they didn't know exactly where they were, east and west. So they were competing technologies. One was star observations, which is practically not useful, and the clock. If you could carry with you a time from a reference point, and that turned out to be Greenwich, England, at the Royal Observatory, if you could carry a clock to sea with you and know what time it was in Greenwich, and then tell what time where you were, and what noon was where you were, you could tell where you were east and west. And so very accurate clocks were required to do that. And John Harrison, over this whole period of the 1700s practically, invented that clock that would go to sea. And they're still running in the Royal Observatory at Greenwich, mm-hmm. in outside London.
We have a caller. Let's bring them into the conversation. We're talking with Bruce Hannon, by the way, this morning. He's a professor emeritus of geography at University of Illinois and is interested in clocks and has now for quite a few years been working on clocks, some interesting clocks around the campus, and we'll tell you about some of that. He also occasionally gives tours of some of these campus clocks. And for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you might want to take advantage of those, and maybe we'll at some point talk about when you think you might be doing that and how people could get information.
Why don't I mention that now before
sure.
I forget?
Oh, yeah, sure.
The way to do this is to send me an email, bhannon, B-H-A-N-N-O-N, at illinois.edu, or call me. I'm in the phone book, too. And I'll put your name on a list. The tours occur irregularly. There'll be another tour in May, and maybe one or two this summer, and then again in the fall. But I do them when I have the time. They're 2 hours long. It's about a mile and a half of walking. There's a lot of history of the campus, its people and its buildings that goes along with it. But there are 8 clocks across the campus from a tower clock that was built in the 1870s and to a clock that used to run all the bells and slave clocks around the campus. Yeah. So bhannon at illinois.edu.
Keep the slaves in order
in time,
there.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, here's a caller in Chicago. Let's talk with him on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Very interesting history. I actually live in East Central Illinois. I'm up here in Chicago on business, and I have an office in Champaign. So my question is a simple one and very self-serving. I have 2 clocks. One's a grandfather clock. It's well over 100 years old with the weights. And the other is a mantle clock with a key. Unfortunately, they're beautiful clocks. Unfortunately, they're both not working presently. And so my question to your guest is, if I were to call him, is she still in the clock repair business? And would there be a chance of having him at least look at my clocks or perhaps even fix them?
Yes, of course. I'm still doing it, and it would be fine. You could use my cell phone number if you want, 217-621-4900.
621-4900.
You got it.
Okay, 490. Okay, right. Very, very good. I appreciate it. One other quick question: the mantle clock. I could, since you're in Champaign, I could easily bring that in. But I live about 50 miles from Champaign as far as a grandfather clock. Is that something that we could discuss, or is that out of your area?
Depends on where you are. I might know someone in your area who could do it. So let's talk.
Very good. Thank you. A very interesting program. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things that I did was that I sort of looked around because I was interested in trying to get a handle on how many people still did this and what kind of training there was. And I came across a quote from someone, and I expect you probably know him, Steve Humphrey. He's the executive director of the National Association of Watch and Clock Collectors. And he, in this article that I came across, he said that as far as he knew, in the United States today, there were only 2 schools that were offering comprehensive clock repair programs. And he said that in the 60s, there were at least 40. And that gets to this question, sort of the question that the listener posed is, well, if who's continuing to do this work now, and is it in fact a vanishing skill?
sort of vanishing. You get down to who needs to know what time it is, and the quartz watch and so on, and the cell phone today supply that information about time. On the other hand, I would say after 40 years, there's probably one mechanical clock per household in Champaign-Urbana. I would guess that. Mm-hmm. Some people have 50 or 60, maybe even more than that, and some people, of course, have none. But I would guess that it would average about one per household. Mechanical clocks. Yep. So what is it about them? The ticking, the striking. People will wake up in the middle of the night if their clock doesn't strike. It's unusual because they were so used to that pattern of sound in the evening. So I have one friend that I work on his clock. I think I could. He has so many. I think I could just reside there as the resident clockmaker. He doesn't keep them on time. He's a great musician, and what he does is let them all drift off time, but strike. And so his house, with that many, I think he has 65, is constantly
something's always
going on and off. And they're friends, and this is a very wonderful sound to him. And if it's off a little bit, you know, the sound is off a little bit, what calls me and says what's going on here, or if one of them stops, of course. A very interesting relationship with mechanical timekeeping. To about 10 now, by now, about 12 years ago, I should back up a little bit. There is a courthouse tower clock in Urbana, the Champaign County Courthouse. And in 1975, in preparation for the bicentennial celebrations, I got after the county because the clock had stopped. And so we restored it in those days with help, a lot of help from various people around the community, and got it running, put the bell back on top. Lightning had struck the tower three times, lowered it about 45 feet, turned it into kind of a sawed-off, not very attractive tower. And we got the clock back up there and made a little stand for the bell, and so returned striking clock to Urbana area anyway. That clock had been, so we got it running in 1975 for the celebration, but that clock had been put in 1883 and is actually a museum quality piece. It's one of the very earliest tower clocks made by Seth Thomas. And it was put in 1883 because that's when standard time and time zones were instituted around the world. And the local people here knew that that was happening, and so set up a clock just in advance. The railroads prior to that time kept accurate time, but they all kept different times. Mm-hmm. They all knew when they were to cross each other's tracks. That was well known. But there was a difference in accurate time within Champaign-Urbana of a half an hour or somewhere in that vicinity. And so once standard time came in, then a public clock is useful, and not that many people had clocks themselves watches themselves, and so this was a very useful thing to do, and it meant something to everybody, the same thing to everyone. So then by 2001, something like that, the clock had stopped again and needed repair, and also I had been pushing over the years for the restoration of the original tower. Steve Beckett calls me and says, "You're the chairman of the Tower Restoration Committee, including fixing the clock." And 10 years later, we raised $1.2 million private funds, just like you folks do. We're able to restore that tower.
Yeah, it just shows you how much trouble you can get in if you decide something needs to be done and you start talking about
yes,
it.
Exactly.
They'll name you the head of the committee
to
take care of the problem.
Right. No good deed goes unpunished. Right. Yeah.
So our good friend Dan McCollum likes to say.
Yeah.
One of his favorite expressions. And what people might not realize is that the clock there that's in the courthouse is indeed a mechanical clock, and it must be wound. Someone has to wind that once a week.
That's right. I insisted that they not put any kind of electrical apparatus on it to wind it. The reason being that when you do that, no one goes up there for a long time until the gears are finally worn out or the bearings are worn out or the motor has quit, and no one knows what the mechanism is supposed to do or how it's supposed to function. By going up there every week, winding it, going up there once a month and oiling it, and reading the manuals that I've written for maintenance of the clock, they now have instilled in them the process by which they can keep this thing running mechanically for indefinite period of time. The county, thanks to Steve Beckett, appointed the head of maintenance for the county, the official keeper of the clock. It's written into his job description. And so he has to be up there every week doing this. So it's a way of keeping the clock running for a very long time.
Yeah.
Electrify it and it'll eventually quit and nobody will know what to do.
We need to take a moment here to remind people about a little bit of maintenance we need to do on this place, and it's kind of like winding our clock in a sense, because in order for us to keep going, we need people to support the station. And that's, you know, that's sort of a euphemism, support the station. I mean, we talk about that, where we really ought to be saying, well, what we're really talking about is you giving us some money, because it takes money to keep the transmitter on and to buy programming and to keep the place running. And the best, most reliable source of funds, the only one that we can rely on growing, is listener support. So that's the bottom line here. We're asking people who listen to the station to help pay a little bit of the cost of keeping the station going. Simple. Wind our clock. That's what we want you to do. We don't want to get Is that a bad thing to say?
No.
We don't want to run down. No. We want to keep going here.
Your support helps keep us ticking. Oh.
How many tortured metaphors can we find? We'll work on it.
All right.
Okay.
217-244-9455. Get that phone number in there and get, you know, we need to get, we're in our last day of the fund drive. I just want to remind people what we're dealing here with Focus. It is the kind of show that only exists in certain places, in certain communities that support something like this kind of show. For 30 years, David has been having guests in here like Bruce Hannon. And by the way, I just wanted to say, you know, we are in a very esteemed company. I remember, actually, you helped save Allerton Park one time in the past. And actually, you did save Allerton Park in the past. And that's another story that we could perhaps tell another time. But all these stories that you hear on Focus, all these great people, we give you access to them. We could air some other show from NPR or from other source, some national broadcast. But that wouldn't give you access to the minds and the great people here in our community, and all the ways that we interact with the ideas and the perspectives that a show like Focus brings. So I just want to make that pitch and ask you to consider how much that means to you, how valuable that is in your life, you know, and just give a little bit to help keep us going. Again, 217-244-9455. That's our pledge line right now, or online at willpledge.org.
Okay, well, we hope that people will respond. We'll talk again in a little bit. Our guest in this hour is Bruce Hannon. He is an emeritus professor of geography at University of Illinois, and we are here talking about something that has been a long-time interest of his, and that is timekeeping clocks, old mechanical clocks. He's done a lot of repair and restoration on clocks, starting, as he explained, with that very first one. He got one and it quit working, and I think the story is that you took the works down to a local jewelry store to see if they could help you, and they looked at it and said, "What's that?" And so you thought, well, okay, maybe I can figure out how this works. And after a while, managed to teach himself and find out what other people would teach him. And so now he's been doing that for some time and worked on a lot of clocks around the campus, and indeed did work on the clock that's in the Champaign County Courthouse. So questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is probably a difficult question to answer. I don't know, but how, as you go from one clock to another and you look at the mechanism and how it works, is there an enormous difference, or are there some ways in which clocks are pretty much the mechanical clocks are pretty much the same?
Both of those are true. There are still changing the technology of timekeeping, improving it, I would say, but actually 700 years of technology here is what I'm faced with. Mm-hmm. The oldest clock I fixed, I think, was from the 1600s. So what's that, 400 or 500 years of technology? So I've never really worked on the original clockworks, but I think I could do that. In any event, trying to get a hold of the ideas and the reasoning behind these things is difficult because of all that long technological history. Mm. So as I say, they're still improving them, and there's still things to learn about them. Yes, my wife thinks I'm trying to just slow down time, control time, so I can slow it down so that I won't age so much, but it turns out that's not true. I can't. One of the things, by the way, listening to the break, was that the weights and springs that drive these clocks mm-hmm. are equivalent or analogous to the contributions that keep this station going. Just a thought. The energy that's required to keep a mechanical clock going is equivalent to the contributions made to WILL.
So the first the first clocks, as their driver, did use the weight that as it fell, mm-hmm. that was the thing
that
made the clock going. And then as it got down to the bottom of whatever its run was, then you had to crank it, and so it would go back up to the top, right. And then it would come back down again.
Right. I think the tower clock in Urbana, the weights fall 45 feet over a week. So somebody has to go back in and wind it up during that time. It takes about 20 minutes of steady winding to get those weights back up to the top. One of them is about 100 pounds. The other is 300 pounds. So it's an effort.
We have some callers here. Let's talk with them. We have someone who clearly must be listening online because they're in Seattle, Washington. We'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Hanna.
How do you do?
Let me ask you this. I'm going to Champaign, and I'm going to have a clock there that was an 8-day clock from 1922.
Okay.
And I've had problems with it since the 1980s.
Well, you should do what I advised an earlier caller to do, and that is give me a call. Use the phone book when you get here, and I can take a look at it.
What is your phone number?
621-4900.
621-4900.
Right.
One thing I don't have is a key.
That I've got, so don't worry about that. Yeah, just give me a call when you get here.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, I didn't really intend for us to drumming up business for you to be doing clock repair, but I guess that what that says is that people have clocks that don't work and they'd like them to work, but they have no idea where to go to find somebody to do that. And I don't know if you opened up the phone book and go to the yellow pages, will you find clock repair there?
There is some one person, I think, that or two that list in the phone book, but I don't because it's a hobby with me, and I am overrun with clocks to fix. But I'm also doing something else, and that is I'm teaching various people around the community how to do this so that I can, let's say, leave the field attended rather than empty. And it does require a special interest and a special mechanical aptitude. So if there's anyone out there that really wants to undertake this process of mechanical timekeeping repair, let me know. Mm.
Is there some way in which you, and perhaps this comes from experience, though, that you could look at a clockworks and just look at it and you'd say, oh, okay, I see this. I see how this all...
Yes, that's right. See how it goes together, and you can see what's wrong with it after so many clocks.
But it takes having looked at a lot of clocks?
Several thousand, probably.
Yeah. There, you've done that many?
I would guess by now. Yeah. 40 years, okay. You're going to see a lot of clocks.
Yeah. When you looked at that first one, was it a total mystery? Did you think
mystery? I have 3 degrees in engineering, so.
Oh, okay.
That helps. But... Well, all that means is that you've had a history of mechanical things somewhere in your background. Uh-huh. Small town, central Illinois, males of my era often went to engineering school if they went to college, right? Because they were exposed to a lot of the way things worked in these towns, as opposed to similar kids being raised now.
And maybe it's some of those guys with the kind of people, and I'm sure that there are now girls as well who see something and decide, how does that work? And their way of figuring that out is to take it apart.
Yes, right.
And if they're lucky, they have to go back together again.
That's right. The classic thing with the clock is taking it apart with the spring in there wound, and all of a sudden,
whang.
It throws gears all over the room, and you give up. But it does take a lot of persistence if you start from that level by yourself. That's for sure.
We're going to talk some more with Bruce Hannon in just a moment. We'll take some more calls. First, though, we have to take a short break. This is Focus.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, offering two performances of the imaginative ensemble Palobolus on April 27th and 28th. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com or 217-333-6280.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We try to mix them up so that there are different things there that we hope will interest you. Tomorrow morning, let me just mention that in the first hour, our guest is Amy Redding. She has written a book that's titled The Mark Inside. The subtitle is A Perfect Swindle, A Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con. And it takes a look at something of the history of cons and con artists in the United States, concentrating in particular on one story. This is the story of a man who was a Texas rancher who in 1919 was the victim of a con. Now, what most people would have done is just tried to deal with the embarrassment and the shame, and they just go on their way, but he didn't. He did something other people didn't do. He decided he was going to get even, and he did, and it's a great story. That's tomorrow. Also tomorrow, we will talk in the second hour about children's health, and there our guest will be Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carl in Urbana. So the kind of questions you might ask of your own pediatrician, you can do that tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your calls and questions. You can go to our webpage, get the schedule. That's will.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. This morning in this part of Focus, we're talking with Bruce Hannon. He's an emeritus professor of geography here at the U of I. We're talking some about his hobby of now some 40 years of fixing and maintaining mechanical clocks. And we have some other callers here. We'll take them in just a minute. And maybe it might, if there are people who are calling in looking for Bruce to help them with fixing clocks, maybe it'd be best if you just contact him. You can send him an email. You can give him a call. But if it's a broader, more clock-related question, we'd be happy to take that. We also would be happy to take a pledge call. Jack Brighton is here with me in the studio.
Hello.
He's our web guru and also former producer of this show, and also has hosted the show a number of occasions, and I think actually done a pretty good job.
Well, thank you.
Pretty good job with that.
I miss the simplicity of radio compared to the web, let me tell you. But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to ask you to call with your support. If you became a friend of WILL last year during our spring drive, for example, then it's time to renew. If you've been happy listening, we hope you have, then you know, give it another try here with your support. 217-244-9455. That's our pledge line. We're asking you to call right now. We're trying to get to 1,100 pledges by the end of today. Actually, you know, the past few days, adding up to 1,100 pledges, and we really need that to reach our year-end fundraising goal to keep all the shows that you hear on the air, including Focus. So if you care about Focus, then please make the call, 217-244-9455.
Yeah, the Found Drive is winding down, and if we want to keep those gears humming, ladies and gentlemen, we need the support of people who listen. It's more than 40% of the money that it takes to run the station. Very important energy source for us. And as I have said, I'm sure many times, all of us had said, we can't do what we do without you. And that doesn't mean that you listen.
Literally.
That's great. But
that's
literally,
right.
That means we can't do what we do without you.
40% of the support, 40% of our funds that support the station come from you. So you are incredibly important, not just as listeners and the people that we're here to serve, but as the people who keep this community functioning, the community of public broadcasting. So once again, you know, if you are a member of our community. We need your support right now. 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org.
All right. Thank you very much. And we do have some other callers here. We'll talk some more with our guest, with Bruce Hannon. Let's do this, and we'll go to, how about Champagne? Champagne in line number two for a caller. Hello.
Hi, Bruce.
Yo.
Hey, I was listening to your comments about the 13th century invention of the mechanical clock, and I guess I have a chicken and egg question for you. How did they come to have the concept of an hour before we had a clock? In other words, don't you have to have a clock that has an hour hand before you know there is something like an hour, which leads to the question, why did we have 24 hours in the day and not 20 or whatever? You can divide it into any number of increments. Do you have any idea about that?
Good question. I used to know. I think I've gone across it several times in the last 40 years, but I can't remember now the exact origin of the 24. 24 is an interesting number. It's divisible by 6 and 4 and 12 and 2. So I suppose that has something to do with it. But otherwise, I think it's arbitrary. The division is arbitrary. And 60 goes the same way, yeah.
It came before the 1300s because those monks knew that they had to wake up every 4 hours.
Right, right, right. It must have been. Or we've just applied that period to them now. I don't know. Yeah. Right, to what it is that they were dividing the daylight, that the rotation of the day into so many, six different segments. So that may have been what they were really doing. So yeah. we call it 4 hours now, but... It might have been, yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, it's a nice question. Good Very question. Good. Sorry, couldn't be more specific.
We'll go. We may have to find some. We can find somebody to do that.
Yes.
We can do that. Over to Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Hmm? As Mr. Inge is aware, I work with wood a lot. And my first cabinet shop I had was back in the mid-70s. And one of the very... interesting things that came in at that first shop was a lady brought me in a wooden clock. She says, it doesn't work. I took a few looks at it and realized that that probably wasn't the type of woodworking I needed to be dealing with at that time. However, since then, and now that I'm more towards retirement age and looking for an interesting hobby, I have found something that Mr. Inge might Google. If he goes to YouTube and... types in mechanical wooden sculptures, you will find things that work with a clock works, but don't tell time. All they do is they force objects to move, and they're all made out of wood, obviously, by the statement I just made. And I'm trying to teach myself how to make them work. And I'm sure you recognize how difficult it is to make a clock work. But I didn't realize until I've gotten started into this, its accuracy is amazing. And, of course, with wood, it makes it a little bit more difficult, and then being a total novice all the way around doesn't help matters much either. But it's very difficult to make a clock work for a long period of time. And the nice things about these things, they do tick, but they run down because you don't want this flying sculpture to go forevermore. You want it to just go for a while and entertain your guest and then stop and you can rewind it. I've wondered, you probably work mainly on metal clocks, don't you?
Well, no, not necessarily exclusively. The early American clocks, let's say around 1800 to 1830, were wooden. The works were wooden and the gears were wooden, and the reason was that there was no brass supply here. You had to buy the brass from England, and they charged a lot. As you could well imagine, they were not on the fully favorable side of the colonies in the states at that time. So they a clockmaker in those days would make a series of wooden clocks through the winter, pack them up on his horse, and adjust the movements, take them to off on a spree of selling them when the weather was good enough. And the people who bought them would, he'd tell them how long the pendulum should be, but they'd have to make that locally, and they made the cases for them locally and the weights. And that gave rise to and the dials, that gave rise to a kind of cottage industry in all over New England and the East Coast until Bridgeport Brass in Bridgeport, Connecticut was founded, and then we started making brass in the 1800s, and then brass clocks came. It wasn't that brass clocks weren't available in Europe or in by purchase from Europe. It's just that we didn't have the brass supply here. As to the artistic use of these things, if you go to the NAWCC webpage and ask for these sorts of things, you'll find all sorts of really very interesting and artistic means of keeping time by wooden mechanisms as well as just art objects. So,
one more time with that?
Oh, NAWCC.
That's the National Association of Watch and Clock Collectors.
Right, but if you just type those initials in, you'll find it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks. Good. And for people who are interested in that sort of thing, I do believe that there is a Champaign County chapter of this organization, right? I think I found them on the web. Oh. Aren't you a member?
I'm a member, but not of the local. Oh, there is.
Okay.
You're absolutely right.
Yes.
Oh, and it's relatively new.
Yes.
Yes, 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 yes. There is. I've even spoken there a couple of times. So, right. I don't know why I didn't respond immediately to your question.
So for people
so
who are interested in, in just learning about them or possibly interested in learning how to work on them, this would be an
excellent
good organization.
Place for it. Yes. Yeah. Why I didn't think to mention this. Yeah. You can get a hold of me again at bhannon@illinois.edu, and I'll direct your name and so on. Your interest to the people who are running that organization here.
So I would think that it would be, even if you use very hard wood, that you would have that a wooden clock that it would wear, would not wear all that well. I mean, mm-hmm. that is, you know, that it that a brass, I'm sure a metal clock with metal gears, as long as it was maintained, should last for a very long time. I wouldn't think that wood would have the durability.
Well, the critical parts of those wooden clocks were brass and steel.
So oh, like the bearing parts?
The axles
parts.
And,
oh, okay.
and the escape okay. mechanism, but the gears and the plates were wood, and uh-huh. that would be the bulk of the brass today in a modern brass a mechanical clock. Yes.
This it gets at this, it's something that maybe people don't really think about, that clocks do need mechanical clocks do need maintenance, and because we do have metal on metal, and clocks, if they get dirty, don't want to work, and they do need to be oiled, and that periodic, if you want, if a clock truly is going to continue to work and work properly, it does have to be periodically cleaned and oiled, right?
John Harrison, in the early 1700s, when he was 21 years old, was asked to make a tower clock for a very wealthy person in London. So it was 1710 or something like that that he built this clock for the man, and it has not stopped for 290 years. And the reason is that he put wooden bushings in that were made from lignum vitae, which is a very, very hard wood from South America. They used to make early bowling balls were made from lignum vitae. Mm-hmm. But this wood also has a kind of an oil inherent in its grain. And so that's why the clock still runs. And his clocks that went to sea, these pendulum-less clocks, also had, the first three of them, had these kinds of lignum vitae bushings, and some of the pinions or gears in them were made from that material. As a result, the Royal Society still runs those clocks from the 1700s continuously. They just wind them up every week. They're on display. And his last clock, which was more like our modern watch, had required oil, required diamond and ruby jewels and so on. As the clocks got smaller, the speed increased and the wear increased proportionately. The modern clock is not run that he made in the late 1700s is not run continuously because it would wear out, even though you would oil it, it would still wear out and would not be a historical artifact. Oh. Whereas these other things that he made earlier, maybe 60, 70 years earlier, are still going because of the way he made them. And the critical element was the wooden bushings. The bearings are wooden.
In the watches that are described as having jewel movements. Yeah. You know, people have heard, right, it, oh, the watch has a 16-jewel movement or 70-jewel movement, something like that. So what is the function of the jewel?
The back up a second. These tower clocks and the old 1300s clocks, the Salisbury Cathedral clock, are ticking, in a sense. They're very slow ticking, very, very slow. Mm-hmm. All the gears turn very slowly. And as you decrease the size of these mechanisms, it's a general principle that the speed increases, has to increase to give you the same output, that one rotation per hour of the minute hand. Mm-hmm. And as the speed increases, the wear increases. So the little axles that are running in the bushings in, let's say, lignum vitae bearings early on, or brass plates, brass bushings, are not sufficient. They would wear out too quickly. The first watches were just like that. They were sort of miniature clocks moving at great rates of speed and wearing out very rapidly. Therefore, the solution was to try gemstones as the bushing, this thing that surrounds the axle, and you have to oil it still, but it wears slowly, but it still wears, and they still crack. Harrison had diamond bushings. Mm-hmm. How he did it, I don't know. How he drilled a hole in diamond, I don't know, but he did it. And he was an extraordinarily clever person.
We have a couple of minutes left. We mentioned a little bit earlier that you have worked on a number of clocks, interesting clocks on the campus, and that occasionally you lead tours, walking tours, so people can take this walk. Takes about 2 hours. You see some of the campus, talk a little bit about some of the architecture, and show people some of these clocks. I don't know if there is a particular one. We actually have a clock here apparently belonged to Gregor Mendel. That's pretty interesting.
Exactly.
The father of genetics.
That's right.
And we also have one that was you talked earlier about the monks having to get up and pray every 4 hours. Well, people here do seem to think that students should be at class on a particular time. So we also have a clock that at one time was the university clock that ran all the other clocks, and that's what made the bells go off for the beginning and the end of class.
That's right. There's a clock in the engineering dean's office now that was in the original powerhouse there on Matthews that ran all the clocks and bells on campus and also gave the control the frequency of the generators, which were in that building. And that's now in the engineering dean's office, set up and running, an extremely accurate clock from 1898. The first tower clock is in a building that the university had and was made by the first mechanical engineering professor here and his student, Fred Francis. That's running in the mechanical engineering lab right next to engineering hall. There are two clocks in the union, another clock in the math library. The president's office has an old clock. Then there is the one in the archives of the main library that was from the 1850s, used by Gregor Mendel, the great geneticist, the founder of modern genetics, as a monk in Brno in Czechoslovakia in 1600, did all these experiments with peas and determined the rules of inheritance. His clock was an alarm clock. It didn't strike a bell every hour, but it woke him up every morning. That clock I managed to restore and is running in the archives every day now. And then the last one was a clock made in Champagne here around the turn of the century in our one clock factory that we had in town. It's now where the Collegiate Cap and Gown building was. That building is the original clock company building. It's called the Herff Jones Cap and Gown Company today on Market Street. There in the Ag Dean's office, I restored that clock to its original form, 1900 form, and it's running all the time too.
Yeah. So you think that perhaps next month, and then maybe a couple of times in the summer,
yes,
that you'll be leading these tours again. So if people would like to get on the list, that probably the easiest thing to do would be just to send you an email.
At bhannon, B-H-A-N-N-O-N, at illinois.edu.
Okay. What, other than just taking something that doesn't work and making it work, which I can understand how that is a satisfying thing, what is it about clocks and clockworks that really appeal to you?
You know, I've thought about that question over the years. Why is it that it appeals? Well, first of all, you're restoring something, which I that sort of fits with my ideas of restoring the tower and the cattle bank and nature, and preserving nature in its original state. It seems like that all fits together. But there's, in this world of fixing them, actually bearing down on it and finding out what's wrong with them and fixing them and getting them going, it's reality. The clock has no personality. I mean, sometimes you wonder, but it doesn't really. And it either works when you've done what you think it needed, or it doesn't. And all my work at the university was theoretical. And so here's my check on reality, my judgment. I thought it needed this kind of fix. And it will let me know whether that was the question, the proper question to have addressed to it or not. It might be that was part of it or something else, or maybe I hit it right on, or maybe I didn't, and I still don't know what's wrong with it. So it's this face-to-face with reality that's also an important aspect of this.
All right. Well, thanks very much for stopping by. Bruce Hannon, he's Emeritus Professor of Geography here at the University of Illinois. Again, bhannon@illinois.edu. You can send him an email if you'd like to go on one of his tours.